You are listening to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. Thanks again for joining me this week. A couple things before we take a mosey on into the briefing room where I give you my view from the blue. If you have not picked up a copy of my book, The Power of Legacy, please check it out on Amazon.com. It is now available in hardcover, softcover, Kindle version, that is ebook, and now it's also available on an audio version. And here's why this book is important. It is an inspirational book because it talks about people who have done amazing things with their lives. I traveled the country talking to people like Frank Shankwitz, who created the Make-A-Wish Foundation, Gary Sinise, who has done some amazing things for veterans, and people whose names that you probably haven't heard but have done amazing things with their lives. And I asked them about who their personal heroes were, with the idea that everybody can become a personal hero. If you touch one life, you have made a difference in this world. Pick up the book. It's called The Power of Legacy, Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People. It's on Amazon.com. Now, there is much to talk about, so let's take a walk into the briefing room where I give you my view from the blue. Well, my friends, once again, police leadership is doing what, unfortunately, police leadership has been doing, and that is running away from their duties to support their police. The latest in this nationwide impotence of law enforcement leaders is taking place in Sacramento. So you're probably aware that there was an officer involved shooting a couple months ago now. I guess it was maybe a month and a half ago. Stephon Clark. Stephon Clark was committing a bunch of auto burglaries in his neighborhood. He was observed, and someone called 911, called the police. Sacramento PD got there. They spotted him. He ran. He was also trying to break into another house. He was being observed by the helicopter, police helicopter. And they were watching him as he's trying to break into things. So the police get there. They pursue him on foot. He runs into a backyard. Turns out that it's his grandmother's house, and he's trying to get in to get away from the police. Now, it's nighttime. The officers are seen confronting him, using the side of the house for cover. And instead of complying with, once again, they're telling him, put his hands up, get on the ground, he doesn't. Instead, he walks towards them, and he raises an object in his hand. Turns out that it's a telephone. But they don't know that. They see him go into what they believe is a shooting stance, point something at them, and they open fire and kill him. Well, Sacramento goes insane. Once again, it's the racist police who are out of control, and they're killing innocent people. And the media wouldn't even talk about the fact that the guy was a career criminal breaking into things when the police get there. Nothing is on the suspect. Everything is on the police. So the officers are put on administrative leave. I believe the investigation is actually still taking place. But now, in typical knee-jerk reaction, the Sacramento Police Department is now requiring cops to consider not even pursuing people on foot. You know, policing changed radically. Their police pursuit policies in the last 15 years. It used to be if you're in a car and you try to get away from the police, they're going to chase you and they're going to get you. Well, no longer. Most police agencies now have very, very restrictive pursuit policies. And as a result, the bad guys know that. And then when the police try to give chase, they drive, that is, the suspects drive in this crazy fashion. They, you know, go 100 miles an hour, blow through lights, and the police stop chasing them. I can't tell you how many serious criminals have gotten away because of it. I know we had an incident here in Vegas not too long ago where the guy took off, the police supervisor called off the pursuit. The guy just committed a murder and the body was in the trunk of the car. But they didn't find that because until he abandoned the car, they just waved to him as he drove away. Well, that's vehicle pursuits. I understand that there has to be common sense applied to this because the vehicle pursuits are so incredibly hazardous. But now they don't even want the police chasing people on foot. I mean, what? Instead of viewing this as what it is, an isolated occurrence where an officer-involved shooting took place, and that will go through the system of justice. Hopefully that these officers will be exonerated for how they saw what they deemed to be a threat and took the proper actions in regards to that threat. But to now change the policy, what are cops supposed to do? I always thought, in my 33 years of being a cop, the whole idea was to catch bad guys. You know, it seems that is no longer the priority of police agencies, or police leaders, I should say. So now the Sacramento Police Department, and I can tell you this, the Sacramento cops are not happy about this. This is their chief, who's only been a chief for not that long. His name is Daniel Hahn, and he says that I'll read it. Sacramento Police Chief Daniel Hahn said the new policy should not be construed as a judgment call regarding how the two officers handled the foot pursuit in Clark's case. Yeah, okay. Of course not. I'm sure that the chief was planning on instituting this new restrictive policy way before that. You know, it's such nonsense. Instead of supporting their cops, they throw them under the bus at every chance that they get. So now, for prior to initiating a foot pursuit, officers are required to activate their body cams, specify the reason for the chase, provide a description of the suspect. They must then identify themselves as police, issue commands for the suspect to stop, and are required to constantly reassess whether or not the pursuit should continue if the suspect runs into a building or an area with hazardous terrain. And then a supervisor can discontinue the pursuit at any time. So here's what happens. Police officers who are proactive are out there trying to do the job. They're trying to put bad guys in jail. So they make a lot of stops. I mean, unfortunately, this has been falling because of the depolicing taking place all over this country. So now a good cop is going to start chasing a suspect, but a police supervisor who wants to show what a great supervisor he is going to cancel these pursuits. I've seen it done time after time after time. As a watch commander with the Las Vegas Metro Police, it was up to me to make a determination if a pursuit was justified and to continue it or discontinue it. Any sergeant could discontinue a pursuit, but there were plenty of times when the sergeant discontinued the pursuit because they didn't want to get in any trouble. Because the least amount that you do, the least you're going to get in trouble. So there were many times when I countermanded the sergeant and said, continue that pursuit, because by policy you can. And this foot pursuit policy is now going to once again devalue the street cop and cause another layer supervision to interfere with the street cops. So once again, police leadership, is showing its true colors, that is yellow, and instead of supporting their cops, creating another roadblock to doing policing. Now, while we're on the subject of police leadership, in Pennsylvania, there was a rookie police officer who responds to a call where a man is clearly deranged, and he's jumping up on moving cars and attacking the people that are in the cars. And he's literally jumping onto them as they're driving down the street. So he's out of his mind, right? The police get a call, and some videotape surfaces showing this guy that, I mean, he's there's no doubt in my mind that when they do the drug screen, they're going to find out that he was on all kinds of dope, either PCP or speed or something. But the guy's deranged. So a single officer gets there. He's got only 7 months on the job. He orders the suspect to stop and to get down on the ground. And once again, we have a non-compliant suspect. And this guy walks menacingly towards the officer who's giving him command after command to stop, stop, stop. And he is about to attack the officer. The officer fires his weapon and kills him. Well, okay, yeah. You have a split second to make a determination if your life is in danger. Well, the district attorney of this county in South Whitehall Township, they, even before the investigation was complete, he arrests the police officer for voluntary manslaughter. Now, this is something you can put this cop in jail for 20 years. The investigation wasn't even done yet. Here we have another political persecution and prosecution. Now, you know, some may say, okay, well, wait a minute. He was unarmed and he didn't beat the police officer. Well, here's the thing. In the last couple of months, two police officers allowed an individual to get so close to them that they were able to fight and disarm the police officer of their own weapons and then kill them with it. This is the reality that police face. This officer made a decision that he's not going to let this guy get hold of him because he's clearly deranged, and if this officer loses the fight, he's going to lose his life. But this goofy prosecutor who doesn't know jack about real law enforcement decides to ruin this police officer's life, charge him with voluntary manslaughter, and now he's in a fight for his life. Now the only light at the end of the rainbow here, or let me put it this way, a silver lining about this is that the community, this is a small community. Well, the community actually has showed support for this officer, including doing a demonstration with carrying signs such as "Let the police do their job" and waving thin blue line American flags. And they did a demonstration to show their support for law enforcement. So this is something that I view as something positive. But it's not enough. Prosecutors need to be held accountable when they make politically motivated decisions to prosecute law enforcement officers. Unfortunately, they have immunity, so the officer can't even sue him once he's found not guilty. And I fully believe that this officer is going to be found not guilty. In relation to officer-involved shootings, I want to talk about another one. Something very interesting happened in Huntsville. It was another officer-involved shooting. And this officer responded to, it's Huntsville, Alabama. He responded to a man with a gun call. The suspect was mentally ill. Apparently they had conflicts with him before, but he was holding a gun. Turned out to be a flare gun, what which is sure can be fatal in and of itself, but it looked like a weapon. It was a flare gun, apparently. The police get there, several officers, and they're telling this guy to put the gun down. And put the gun down. When he raised it, one of the officers opened fire, shot him, and killed him. Okay. The investigation was completed. The officer was cleared. End of story, right? Well, unfortunately, no. Because a district attorney, clearly motivated by politics, went to a grand jury and indicted him for murder. Yeah, you heard me right. Murder. And now the officer, of course, is placed under arrest. But here's the rub for this one. I saw the press conference that the chief gave, and the chief gave a very, very supportive of the officer briefing to the media. And he said in no uncertain terms, this officer is not a murderer. And the town council, in which goes against almost everything that I've seen in recent years, voted to pay for the attorney of the officer and keep him on paid status while he's going through this sham of a murder trial. This is something I haven't seen. I don't think I've ever seen. So in one instance of a prosecutorial attempt to put a police officer in jail in Pennsylvania, we have the community standing up for that officer. And in Huntsville, where another politically charged persecution and prosecution with a police officer has resulted in an incredible show of support by the police administration and by the city. I hope that this is a turning point. It is unfortunate that we are seeing more and more of these political attacks where these officers are defending themselves and then have to defend themselves again in court. This is true injustice in every sense of the imagination. And that, my friends, is my view from the blue. One thing I remember so vividly from my days on the street was wearing body armor. Now, I gotta tell you, it's not very comfortable. Saves lives, but it is hot. And when you take it off at the end of the day, it's drenched with sweat, doesn't smell so good, and it's always an issue. So there is a new invention, and it is an odor eliminator, basically called, it's a spray. It's a spray, and it's great for arresting odors. So they actually call it Arrest My Vest. This is some amazing stuff. You don't have to just use it for that. You can use it for tactical gear, for your gear bag, for gym clothes, for all kinds of stuff. But this is, it works. It's not expensive. There's unscented, there's scented. And I would certainly advise you, because this is a great product, to check out. You're gonna love the name of this website, stinkyvest.com. So go to stinkyvest.com. It's an amazing product. It is a necessary product, unfortunately, and it's really specifically for law enforcement officers, for their tactical gear and their vest. It's Arrest My Vest Spray. Check it out, stinkyvest.com. To all my active duty law enforcement out there, as well as if you are a business owner, you need security, I want you to listen to this message. This is really important because there is an organization out there. It's a company called Law Enforcement Specialists. And they're out of Arizona, but they have a full nationwide reach for employing off-duty officers for security and traffic assignments. You know, almost every law enforcement officer I know works, they call them extra jobs, in order to make ends meet. Because let's face it, we're not exactly paying our law enforcement officers a whole lot of money. So they have to do extra jobs in order to make ends meet and put food on the table and have a couple vacations. So law enforcement specialists, they have agreements with all kinds of police agencies around the country. You have to just contact them, and they will put you to work. So if you are a law enforcement officer, you want to work extra assignments, these jobs that come up, sometimes through your department, but you can get more of them through law enforcement specialists. So check them out at offdutypoliceofficers.com. That's offdutypoliceofficers.com. And if you are in need of security, if you are in need of hiring law enforcement officers for security or traffic assignments, give them a call as well. That's offdutypoliceofficers.com. Phone number is 855-976-4757. And I can tell you from firsthand experience that these folks know what they're doing, and they are dedicated to assisting law enforcement officers. That's offdutypoliceofficers.com.
The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. It's AmericaOutloud.com, where the conversation never ends. With 24/7 streaming on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount, or call 844-869-9958.
With me today, in the interview room of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is an extraordinary man, someone who is a United States Army veteran of the Cold War era and the California Army National Guard during the post-9/11 era. During his break in military service, he also served with U.S. Secret Service, the Los Angeles Police Department, and as a special agent for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. His resume is amazing, but what he is doing now is equally amazing. In 2017, he founded Save a Warrior and was declared a winner at the second annual VA Brain Trust, Pathways to Innovation for its disruptive and pioneering approach to ending veteran suicide. I welcome to the show Jay Clark, president and founder of this amazing organization. Jake, thanks so much for taking the time to be on Blue Lives Radio.
Hi, Randy. It's a real privilege to share with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I want to talk to you about what you have created and why, and how you are literally affecting the lives of veterans and first responders in a really dramatic fashion. And how you're going to move forward with your success. You have created this this organization, Save a Warrior. Tell us about that. What was it that led up to this founding? And let's start there.
Thanks, Randy. You know, it was a long time coming. 21 years ago, I was you know, relatively speaking, a young FBI agent. I was 31 years old. I was about a year out of Quantico, and I knew I was in the wrong space. I knew I was in the wrong fit, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. And I had been in the Army. I'd been a uniformed division Secret Service officer. I'd worked the streets of L.A. as police officers, police detective. I worked a federal crime task force. I went to school at night, and you know, and then I became a federal agent. and walking across the stage that day, like I knew I was doomed to failure, because what all of that ambition and achievement and motivation had done for me, you know, over a 16-year period, was just knock a God-sized hole in me, and I didn't know how to fill it. And I was chasing ghosts of praise and validation, and I was what we now refer to as an athlete warrior. I was all about what I look like on the outside from head to toe, and defeat, conquer, collect the rewards. But there was nothing filling up the inside of me, and I suspected on some level that that was the case for maybe, you know, a fair amount of my contemporaries. I'd seen this in the military, I'd seen it in law enforcement, I'd seen it at the federal level, but nobody talked about these things. There were things you just didn't talk about. And what's interesting, just like in the family I grew up in, there were things you didn't talk about. And for some reason, in my early 20s, I was drawn to comparative mythology. It was part of my undergrad. I was drawn to a lot of the new age self-help stuff because I lived in Southern California. I went through a variety of initiations. I was very, very curious. And that fire had been lit when I was 12, 13 years old and read The Call of the Wild. And it transported me, and it transported me away from a dysfunctional family that included, you know, mental illness and violence and blackout drinking and compulsive gambling and isolation and fear and shame and trauma. And this book took me away. And I didn't connect the dots at the time until about 15 years later, but there was something about story. There was something about narrative. There was something about getting lost in that recreation. And, you know, 6 years ago when I was in graduate school at Pepperdine, and I was seeing all the people coming back that I had helped train to go to Iraq and Afghanistan, people I'd served with on deployments I had done to Kosovo, I saw this rate of suicide going through the roof. I'd been hearing things from people I had still known on the LAPD, and I thought, you know what? Just a lot of things came together and catalyzed kind of in one moment in the spring of 2012. I got laid off. On Friday the 13th, I was working for a Fortune 15 company, and I said, you know what, you're 46 years old. If you're going to create this conversation to do for you, to do for others what wasn't there for you 15 years ago when I left the Bureau, you're going to do it now. Because here's the thing, I needed help. I needed real help. I needed a real diagnosis. I needed somebody to tell me, listen, this is what the issue is. That dysfunctional family, those adverse childhood experiences, that's trauma. And what you're going to put on top of that, because this is the way the brain works, is you're going to put shame on top of that. And what you're going to do to cover up that shame, you're going to put a layer of acting out and acting in on top of that. And then on top of that, the universe is going to give you consequences. Okay? The downside is you have the ability to do something in the area of 3 out of 4 of those, but not the fourth, because the world is going to, you know, reality is going to be reality. It's going to respond accordingly. But we can help you. But see, we can help you deal with what you're dealing with. That didn't happen. It was basically like, sorry, it didn't work out here. Good luck with your life. And don't let the door hit you on the butt on the way out. And I find that this is the case in law enforcement agencies and in first responder agencies, are that people are so afraid of coming forward and saying, listen, I believe that I'm fully capable, qualified, and competent to do this job, but something's not right and I need some support. And that's why Save a Warrior was created, to give people a novel way of looking inside of themselves, to get down to the thing under the thing and begin to heal from their childhood trauma, which is at the basis of all of this acting out behavior that gets them in trouble in their careers.
Well, that's a mighty big chunk to gnaw on. I mean, what was it that affected you that you became aware of the dangers of post-traumatic stress and how it related to your formulating this idea?
You know, I noticed when I had come back from Kosovo that I had problems driving across bridges and tunnels, and that was really odd. You know, I felt that I was a fairly resilient guy. And, you know, when you're in, you know, the zeitgeist of what's happening in the world of the people around you, and you have an ear tuned to the spirit of the time, like, I knew something here was wrong. But I also knew enough through my own studies and my own, you know, journey through recovery that we come equipped with very powerful internal adaptive mechanisms. So how could I knock enough granola and patchouli off of that in Southern California to make a veteran and or first responder feel comfortable to sit down? Well, the first thing they do is they look at this resume that you just read off. And yeah, on its face, it's an impressive resume, and I'm proud for the efforts that went into that. But you know what? If you step back from that and you look at that resume forensically, the way a psychologist might, they'd be like, what are you chasing? Why are you so ambitious? Why wasn't a military career enough for you? Why wasn't a career at the Secret Service enough for you? Why wasn't the LAPD enough for you? And what happened at the Bureau? Well, I was one of the lucky people that went through this ultimate meltdown known as a catabasis. And when I say lucky, I was lucky that it happened because it rerouted my life, but lucky in the sense that it didn't kill me, because that was something I should not have survived. As a matter of fact, I was suicidal for the better part of a dozen years or so. I didn't want to live anymore because I didn't have the titles. I didn't have the station. I didn't have the status. I didn't have the hustle. You know, so who am I now? If you take away all the titles, who am I? And thank God those wheels came off, because I finally got to do the bucket work a day at a time that was necessary to find out who I am and what I was meant to do and what my purpose and calling and what my meaning, where I found meaning in life. And it's by serving others. And that's really what we're all looking for. But we get stuck in these lower levels of this athlete, warrior, archetypal, fixed way of being in our life. And we don't know that there's another way to feel inside. And we don't know that there's another way to live. And we don't hear enough that to get what we really want in life, we got to help enough others get what they want first. We don't believe that because we struggle being ordinary. We sometimes lack humility. And there's a dearth of faith in the rank and file, because we believe that, you know, this guy's either a copper or he's an asshole. It's all black and white thinking. We don't live it in the gray. And when we learn to, you know, use these practices that have been around for thousands and thousands of years, when we go through a proper initiation, when we take on a daily practice with an emphasis on serving others, the only thing that changes about our life, Randy, is everything. And that's why people that walk out of SAW a year, two, three, 4 years later say their life is a miracle, because a miracle is just a shift in perspective. And I'm going to tell you, you're not going to read some book about your parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system and game this and heal, because it's just acting as if and more, better, different, more of the same. We are pseudo-initiated into the world of law enforcement, first responder, military. We don't even know we're being ripped off. And we're being ripped off at the level of our spirit and the level of our soul. And what we do at SAW is we do in 5.5 days this proper initiation, so that people are able to access parts of themselves that they didn't know were available to them. And they begin to feel freer. They begin to feel more like themselves. The suicidal thoughts go away. They titrate off the meds. They learn how to meditate. They learn what it looks like to practice good self-care. And they become more of themselves, with no patchouli, no granola, nothing weird, just some really well-grounded, commonsensical, best practices approach to healing from trauma.
When you come to Save a Warrior and you go through the 5 day or 5.5 day, I'm not going to say word deal, but the experience, how does it actually, I mean, where does it take place? What are the physical surroundings, and how many people are there and are they from all different types of military and first responders?
Yes. I'll start with your last question first. Yes. It's an interesting milieu that comes together in that cohort of military and or first responder background, or both. And we originated the conversation in Malibu, California. We kick it off at Pepperdine University in the business school up top in the graduate campus. And then we make our way to our camp overlooking the ocean on the Malibu-Ventura County line. So it's a beautiful set and setting, 13 people in a cohort, 12 warriors, one civilian witness. There's always a witness, that's an important component to have it, because witnessing is a trauma. We do cohorts in Malibu. Warrior Village outside of Columbus, Ohio goes live 26 August. But this program exists in derivative forms in around the country, as far away as Canada and Australia. But the original conversation is in Malibu. It's also in Ohio, and we're looking at an additional location with a behavioral healthcare company up in Napa Valley that has a strong background in wanting to serve first responders, you know, through our discovery model, along with traditional recovery approaches inside of, you know, those kind of contained facilities. And the way people get together is we have an application process where people go through what's known as rostering. There's enrollment and registration, and we're very, very surgical in that approach, because the waiting list has been in existence since we have, and it's not a question of whether or not somebody's worthy. Everyone is worthy to sit in that seat, but are they ready? Are they ready to have an experience over which they'll never get? Because there's nothing like this experience. If you want an experience like this, you're going to give Tony Robbins $8,000 of your money, and you're going to do it with 2,500 other people, and you're going to have a great time. But it's going to be high flash, high concept. We do it very high touch, very concentrated dose. We're doubling our capacity. A year or two from now, it'll be tripled, quadrupled, and we'll be able to take 400 or 500 people a year through the program, because our donor base has grown. The first responder donor base has grown, because agencies have the ability, are seeing the results, and they want to sit their people in those seats. More than 50 agencies have sent their people to save a warrior. We don't advertise. It's all word of mouth. But as we begin to grow in our social media presence, as people, you know, find their way to us and see the documentary footage that was done, usually warriors look at one of the movie trailers and say, you know what? That looks like exactly something that might help me, because people come to us at their most desperate hour. We're the last house on the block. When everything else has failed, when they're at that critical juncture, is when they're absolutely ready to sit in that seat, because they're desperate enough to take direction at that point, because we, in first responders, we know everything. See, we know stuff. You can't tell us anything, right? Even though we have continuing education and what have you, like, we know what we know, we know what we don't know, but we don't know what we don't know, and we don't know the unknown world that initiation takes place in. I just, by hook or by crook, I got dropped into one of these Oz-like experiences when I was leaving the Bureau, and it changed my life. It changed the way I live my life, the way I look at life, the way I love, the way I approach life, the way I'm open to life, the way I accept life. And yeah, and I still had that resume. And yeah, I was shit hot in those jobs, and the people that I work with would say that. But something wasn't right. And that's what we get underneath, is the non-shareable problem that you swear you're going to take to your grave, that's actually going to put you in your grave if you don't get it processed. That's what happens at SALT, Randy. Let's separate out what SALT is. SALT rises to the level of discovery. SALT provokes a quantum or an aha moment through a variety of threshold experiences to do that. So what happens is the suicidality is displaced, and a person is experiencing this sense of being high on Friday afternoon and wondering, where did all my psychic pain just go? And it's like, don't worry. If it's not everything we said it is, we'll cheerfully refund your misery. No questions asked. So far, ask for their misery back. Okay, so now what? Now what do I do that I'm back in the four corners like Chuck Nolan and Castaway, and I've gotten off the island, and I've lost Wilson, and Kelly's not there, and now I've got to go forward in life. What do I do now? Well, there's these things called community resiliency models. Some people know them as Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Adult Children of Alcoholics / Dysfunctional Families. Most of our folks, because of the adverse childhood experiences and what we determine through that enrollment process, which takes about 28 days. See, we have a lot of dialogue before the person ever has the experience. They have a group now, a cohort, a community, a tribe of 13 people with whom they hold one another accountable with unconditional positive regard. And they know what the next steps are for them and where they have to go to continue their healing. And this was the missing for me 21 years ago. No one at the Bureau said, hey, we're going to press pause here. And we understand, based on the behavior that you're displaying and what you've shared with us in a safe environment, because, you know, if you tell on yourself, we're not going to take your job. That wasn't an option for me. If I really went to them and said, this is what's really going on with me, they'd have been like, somebody punch this kid's meal card, no dessert, and get him out of the building. But I was worthy of help. I was worthy of support. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know how to speak in my own truth at the time and stand in my own grit and say, listen, wait a second, hold on a second here. I got 14 years in this game and I'm not going out with Wednesday's trash. I didn't have the internal, you know, dialogue and resources to do that. So what we're doing and what's happening today is there's a different listening in the agencies of departments saying we've put a lot of resource and time into people, and there's an opening. We're in this age of healing where city managers and chiefs of police and chiefs of fire are saying, look, you know, I actually want to help my people heal and I want to help them preserve their careers. This is a dawning of a new age. Now, this isn't everywhere, but this is in enough places that people are beginning to wake up and say, you know what, it might be safe for me to go ask for help.
You know,
when you have that, changes the game.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think this is really a one of the most important issues, is that there are so many first responders, so many police officers that are very hesitant to come forward because of A, they're worried about getting put on the rubber gun squad, B, that even get terminated simply for asking for help. So I mean, I agree with you that times are a changing, and there is a more of a movement pushing forward to get people accept that people need some help. But still, there are so many law enforcement agencies that if a guy or a gal goes to request assistance for psychological or trauma issues, they're playing with their lives and their careers.
Okay, let's touch on three quick issues here. Number one, it all starts with the leader of the agency. If that leader's allegiance is to the city manager and their retirement plan, you got a better chance of seeing the Pope naked than getting help from that person. That person is not a leader. That person is working on a retirement plan. Secondly, if you have a peer-to-peer support model in your agency and you're sitting across from Joe or Jane, and Joe or Jane says to you, I'm going to let you be vulnerable to the point that it threatens my own mortgage and my kids in private school, you got a problem. Semicolon, however, if you have leadership that says, listen, I value you. You matter to me. This community matters to me. You feeling safe matters to me. And I am polished enough. I am emotionally and spiritually mature enough to understand that you are a spiritual being having a human experience, and that shit happens. And when shit happens, I will do everything I can to get you the support that you require. If you meet me halfway, you would transform law enforcement in 5 years. Okay, now the great news is the person that heads up the FBI National Academy Association and the chapters around the country that deals with these executives, he gets that. He has a listening for that, because here's the deal. I lost my career. I lost everything, but I didn't lose my life. I didn't lose my dignity, and I didn't lose all of my self-worth. I took my rusty ass into those rooms that ended anonymous, and I put my head down, acted ordinary, found some humility, and walked in faith, and was given freely that which would have been given to others. And the only thing they ever asked me was, pay this forward, find a way to pay this forward. I was also told in recovery, we do what we're trained to do. Well, the circumstances under which I left the Bureau, you know, I don't know if law enforcement was done with me or I was done with it or a little bit of both, but I always sensed that I was going to find my way back into the conversation. This is the role that my Creator chose for me. Brother, I will take it, because I live 7 days of Saturdays getting to do what I do, and I don't know why I got the job. I don't know why I'm the guy that pulled the sword out of the stone. I'm the last guy that I would have given this job to, but I got the job, and I take it seriously, and I understand the fear. I understand the fear And I understand the trauma underneath the fear of that first responder who looks, you know, shit hot from top to bottom in that uniform. But I know underneath, a lot of the people that come to see me, the dialogue inside is, if they find out who I really am, this agency is going to move me down the road. Not necessarily, because once you heal and once you have a transformational experience, you are the best thing going on inside of that agency, whether they know it or not, because your experience can now benefit another and maybe save someone's life. And I've seen it hundreds and hundreds of times where someone goes back to an agency and 6 months later, somebody says, come here, man, what happened to you? Well, you know, I went out to Malibu. They took the patchouli and the granola away and they had me pet the pony and they taught me how to meditate. And I did what they told me to do. And my life is amazing now. And I feel better and I'm working through my stuff. And then the person says, do you think you can get me into that organization now? Then that started with the LAPD. And at first, Behavioral Sciences Services fought tooth and nail to have their people come out to our experience. But then all of a sudden, their suicides went down. And then there's a correlation. And now I can't keep the LAPD out of the building. You know, now there's, you know, MOUs being formulated. Now there's reimbursement through MHN. And now they're paying for the seat, as that city should, because somebody's life is receiving a service. And rather than taking that person out of duty for 30, 45, 60 days and sending them to Betty Ford or Pasadena where they're sitting next to somebody they might have put the cuffs on, you're putting them in a place where you can preserve their dignity, give them exactly what they require, and put them back into their lives within a week where they absolutely understand what's next for them in their healing journey. If it wasn't so simple, it would be ridiculous. What we do is very, 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 very simple. It's just not easy because we have to. Yeah, but there's no clinicians here. I know. It's a wounded healer, warrior-led experience. It's archetypal. It goes back to Jung. It goes back to the founding, you know, of 12-step. It goes back to Joseph Campbell and the monomyth of the hero's journey. But the good news is on Sunday afternoon when we kick it off, we invite these skeptics to sit in the back of the auditorium for the first 3 hours during the introduction, and they walk out with their mouths open going, how do we not know about this? I don't know. It might be inversely proportional to how much you give a shit about your people, because I'm under the impression of what we seek seeks us. So when the leaders and the city managers actually start to legitimately care about their people, we'll have to open a dozen branches around the country.
And I promise. I hope for that day. I sincerely do. So we're running out of time. But
I'll say this. Our organization, West Coast Trauma, IAFF, these hard facilities that have an ongoing live operation, the waiting lists are astronomical. And it's unbelievable how many people want to come have this kind of an experience because it's short in duration and it's effective and it's necessary. But go ahead with your question, Randy.
How does my listeners who might be troubled, might feel that they can that they would benefit from attending, or the police leaders who listen to this, how do they find out more about it or contact you in order to get into a program?
The best way, if they're listening to this interview and something resonates for them, I would go to the website for saveawarrior.org, go to the media page, and look at some of the documentary footage that it's been cut down into vignettes and rip reels, because we've benefited from about $5 million in free production quality filming over the last 6 years that really gives you a nice insight. And then the website gives a great deal of written material as to what is the philosophy that underpins, you know, the catalyzing, disruptive innovation that's happening at Saul. Saul was created in a business school, not a school of social work, and that's an important distinction. And then if they're moved and want more information, they should just reach out to Brian Haggerty at brian@sablewarrior.org, because Brian heads up our rostering process. He's also 22 years retired from LAPD, and he's a former military vet. And he understands the fear on the other end of the line. And we have Brian, we have Mark Lima, we have Maddie Fiorenza, myself. We've got a handful of us that handle that rostering process that can answer those questions. And I would just share with people, look, hang in there. Warrior Village opens up the end of August, which again more than doubles our capacity. We're looking to move into a future site, potentially in Napa Valley. But this is what I would say to somebody out there who's thinking about harming themselves or they're thinking about giving up. Listen, you have no idea how much different life can feel for you. I've been there. I get it. And I was told in recovery, if you kill yourself in the first 5 years, you've killed the wrong person. Okay. What I'm saying is I understand the pain is valid. It's legit. It's real. But it's not you. You're not the pain. You're not the emotions, and you're not those feelings. And when you earnestly go seeking for a spiritual solution to a spiritual problem rather than a material solution for a spiritual problem, that house, that relationship, that new set of shoes, that new shiny gun, that next promotion, it will not save you. You are putting gasoline on a fire. What you need to heal is inside of you, and this movement toward taking your own life is really your call to healing. If you listen for the wisdom inside of that pain, that's how we heal, is we go in through the wound, because we don't heal the wound heals us. And that's what you learn at Saul.
I know that you're doing amazing work, and you're really making a difference.
Appreciate you. God bless, man. Thank you for what you're doing, Randy.
Those of you who have followed me for any length of time know that in addition to being a 33-year law enforcement officer, I'm also an author. I've written 4 books, The True Blue, Police Stories by Those Who Have Lived Them, A Cop's Life, True Blue to Protect and Serve, and my latest book, which was actually just released only a couple weeks ago, is The Power of Legacy, Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People. It's a much different book than what I've written before, but it is truly an inspirational book because I had traveled the country talking to people who have done amazing things with their lives, people like Frank Shankwitz, who, when he was an Arizona State Trooper, created the Make-A-Wish Foundation, Gary Sinise, who's done amazing things for military and law enforcement, and a number of people, some names you know, some names you don't, but this book is full of inspiration. Changed my life doing this book. Now, here's something I'm going to share with you. You know, I have a lot of Facebook followers, you know, more than 25,000 of them. But Facebook is not allowing me to share the message of my book. I think they call it shadow banning, and it's very, very disturbing. So I'm going to ask your help. First of all, I would love for you to go to Amazon.com. It's available on Kindle. It's available on audiobook, and of course in hardcover and softcover. I would love for you to pick up a copy of this book, share it with your children, because it is full of inspiration about how everyone can become a personal hero. But I'd also ask you to share this information with your friends on Facebook and other social media, because I'm fighting an uphill battle. Shadow banning is a real thing. I go to share it with my followers, and it keeps on getting unapproved, saying it's too political. There's nothing political about this book. It's about good people. I'd ask for you to share this message. I need your help to get this message out, because this book can change the world. When you talk about becoming a personal hero, you change the life of one person. You add to that person's life, and you change the world. So if you would, check me out on Amazon.com. All my books are available there. But The Power of Legacy, Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People. And I appreciate your support. For those of you who are involved in investigative work, there is an amazing software that you've got to take a look at, from Blue Light LLC. And Blue Light is a company owned by a retired Special Forces Sergeant Major. He is a strong supporter of law enforcement. And this software is amazing. It is incredible for conspiracy investigations, narcotics investigations, homicide. It's called Analyst Notebook. And it's a product that has been used very, very successfully in bringing down a lot of bad guys. The reason the Special Forces Sergeant Major got involved in it is because he used to use it in the Middle East for discovering IED, improvised explosive devices, originators and their networks. But it's great for civilian police work. So check it out, Blue Light LLC, it's Analyst Notebook, and it is an amazing product. Check it out.
End of Watch with Randy Sutton.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we pay our respects to the men and women of the profession who have made the ultimate sacrifice, given their lives in the line of duty. Unfortunately, this week I have two more names to read. The first is Officer Kirk A. Grease of the California Highway Patrol. Officer Kirk Grease was struck and killed by a vehicle while conducting a traffic stop on I-80 near Manuel Campos Parkway in Solano. Another vehicle entered the area and struck both Officer Grease and the vehicle he had stopped. Officer Grease and the driver of the stopped car were both killed. Officer Grease was a U.S. Marine Corps veteran, served with the California Highway Patrol for 19 years. He is survived by his wife and two daughters. Officer Kirk A. Grease, California Highway Patrol, End of Watch, August 10th, 2018. The second officer to die in the line of duty was Officer Fadi Shakur of the Detroit Police Department. The Detroit Police Department has announced that Officer Fadi Shakur, who was severely injured in a hit-and-run accident on August 4th, has died of his injuries. Officer Shakur had only been with the police department for a year and a half. He was struck when he was walking to his cruiser after responding to a crowd control call on August 4th. Officer Fadi Shakur, Detroit Police Department, Detroit, Michigan, End of Watch, 8/14/2018. May these two officers rest in peace. I want to thank you for listening once again to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. Now, I want you to keep in mind that this radio broadcast, podcast that is heard and downloaded, is also on Live Talk Radio. It reaches about 200,000 people, has about 200,000 listens on Live Talk Radio, and about 100,000 downloads on podcast. A large law enforcement audience, of course, and people that support us. So if you are an advertiser and you want to reach this audience, I would ask you to contact me at randylsutton@live.com. That's randylsutton@live.com. And we can talk about advertising your business on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. Thanks again. We'll see you next week.